Hello, and welcome to the Phantasms of the Living podcast. I'm your host, the paranormal author and musician, Simon Thought, coming to you from New England, USA. As you may know, this series covers case studies from the seminal two-volume, massive work known as Phantasms of the Living, published in 1886 by the Society for Psychical Research in England. The society was made up of both skeptics and believers in the paranormal, and conducted research into various areas in an attempt to prove whether such phenomena were real or not. As I did in the last episode, I want to take a break from Phantasms of the Living and dip some more into the book entitled Phantasms of the Dead by Harroward Carrington, which I recently bought. Mr. Carrington was a member of the Society for Psychical Research both in England and America, and worked investigations for them as a researcher. He was very critical of paranormal claims and was able to debunk certain mediums as frauds. This led to friction with some of the Society's members who did not at all like this debunking activities, which included Sherlock Holmes author Arthur Conan Doyle. Carrington then went out on his own, conducting many paranormal investigations around the United States and writing numerous books, with one of his most famous being the book originally entitled True Ghost Stories, and later called Phantasms of the Dead, or True Ghost Stories, in the subsequent editions. Today we're going to read about two investigations which Carrington puts into a category which he modestly calls ghost stories of a more dramatic nature. While I think that all the stories told so far in this podcast have been interesting, or at least the methods of investigation into them have been interesting, the stories in this episode are the scariest to date. I just want to let you know that in advance. While logging into my computer to create this episode, I was given the two-factor identification number of 666, which, as you will see, could be taken as either a warning or an encouragement to cover this topic. I will assume the latter and carry on. The first topic we will cover is what Carrington calls disease phantoms, but first, a little introduction from Carrington. In the cases which are adduced in the present chapter, the standard of evidence cannot be considered so high. Many of them have been recorded in good faith as actual experiences, but they will probably fail to carry conviction to the same extent as those of which have gone before. Still, many of these narratives are singularly striking and interesting, and for this reason deserve to be included in this volume. The reader may therefore place any construction he may choose upon these cases, as they are presented not as evidence, but as entertainment. I shall begin with some personal experiences of a Scotch seer who, according to his own accounts, has experienced some of the most dramatic and remarkable manifestations conceivable. Disease phantoms. Mr. Elliot O'Donnell, a man about whom it has been said that the gates of his soul are open on the hell side, has had many strange experiences with spirits, mostly evil and horrible, and has recorded these in his books Ghostly Phenomena, Byways of Ghostland, etc. From his voluminous writings on his own personal experiences, I cite a few cases to show the character of the phenomena. I have from time to time witnessed many manifestations which I believe to be superphysical, both from the peculiarity of their properties and from the effect their presence invariably produce on me, an effect I cannot associate with anything physical. One of the first occult phenomena I remember appeared to me when I was about 5 years of age. I was then living in a town in the west of England, and had, according to the usual custom, been put to bed at 6 o'clock. I spent a very happy day playing with my favorite toys, soldiers, and not being in the least degree tired, was amusing myself with planning a fresh campaign for the following morning, when I noticed suddenly that the bedroom door, which I distinctly remember my nurse carefully latching, was slowly opening. Thinking this was very curious, but without the slightest suspicion of ghosts, I sat up in bed and watched. The door continued to open, and at last I caught sight of something so extraordinary that my guilty conscience at once associated with the devil, with regard to whom I distinctly recollected to having spoken that afternoon in a skeptical, and I frankly admit, very disrespectful manner. But far from feeling the proximity of that heat which all of those who profess authority on satanic matters ascribe to Satan, I felt decidedly cold. So cold indeed that my hands grew numb and my teeth chattered. At first I only saw two light, glittering eyes that fixed themselves upon me with an expression of diabolical glee, but I was soon able to perceive that they were set in a huge, flat face covered with fulsome-looking yellow spots about the size of a three-penny bit. I do not remember noticing any of the other features save the mouth, which was large and gaping. The body to which the head was attached was quite nude and covered all over with spots similar to those on the face. I cannot recall any arms, though I have vivid recollections of two thick and to all appearances jointless legs, by the use of which it left the doorway and, gliding noiselessly over the carpet, approached the empty bed placed in a parallel position to my own. There it halted, and thrusting its misshapen head forward, it fixed its malevolent eyes on me with a penetrating stare. On this occasion, I was far less frightened than on any of my subsequent experiences with the occult. Why, I cannot say, as the manifestation was certainly one of the most hideous I've ever seen. My curiosity, however, was far greater than my fear, and I kept asking myself what the thing was and why it was there. It did not seem to be composed of ordinary flesh and blood, but rather of some luminous matter which resembles the light emanating from a glowworm. After remaining in the same attitude for what seemed to me an incalculably long time, it gradually receded, and assuming all of a sudden a horizontal attitude, passed headfirst through the wall opposite to where I sat. Next day, I made a sketch of the apparition and showed it to my relatives, who, of course, told me I'd been dreaming. About 2 weeks later, I was ill in bed with a painful, if not actually dangerous, disease. I was given an account of this manifestation at a lecture I delivered 2 or 3 years ago in B, and when I had finished speaking, I was called aside by one of the audience who very shyly told me that he too had had a similar experience. Prior to being attacked by diphtheria, he had seen a queer-looking apparition which had approached his bedside and leaned over him. He assured me that he had been fully awake at the time and had applied tests to prove that the phantom was entirely objective. A number of other cases, too, have been reported to me in which various species of phantasms have been seen before various illnesses. Hence, I believe that certain spirits are symbolical of certain diseases, if not the actual disease creators of the bacilli from which these diseases arise. To these phantasms, I have given the name of Morbos. That spirits can be the harbinger of disease is not an uncommon theory. Are the spirits satanic and showing the percipient the disease that the spirit will give them, or is the apparition more of a warning to take care of oneself because one has been exposed or is susceptible to a certain illness? This was definitely on my mind when I saw the 666 two-factor identification code to open my computer when I was creating this episode. It really is easy to start your own podcast. It's an inexpensive and fun way to expand your reach and provide opinions and interests to others. Buzzsprout is the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Your show can be online and listed in all the major podcast directories within minutes of finishing your recording. Podcasting isn't hard when you have the right partners, and the team at Buzzsprout is passionate about helping you succeed. Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout to get their message out to the world. Following the link in this show's notes lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and helps support our show. We use Buzzsprout, and I can say it took no time at all to get this podcast out to you. I could not have done it without Buzzsprout's help. Podcasting isn't hard. You just have to know who to work with. Get out there and get talking now. The next, more dramatic investigation is entitled The Tale of the Mummy, which is pretty frightening and is a departure from the more haunted house type stories that I've covered from Phantasms of the Dead so far. The Tale of the Mummy. During one of my sojourns in Paris, says Mr. Elliot O'Donnell in his Byways of Ghostland, I met a Frenchman who, he informed me, had just returned from the East. I asked him if he had brought back any curios, such as vases, funeral urns, weapons, or amulets. Yes, lots, he replied, 2 cases full. But no mummies, mon Dieu, no mummies. You ask me why? Ah, thereby hangs a tale. If you will have patience, I will tell it to you. The following is the gist of his narrative. Some seasons ago, I traveled up the Nile as far as Assiout, when there, managed to pay a visit to the grand ruins of Thebes. Among the various treasures I brought away with me was a mummy. I found it lying in an enormous lidless sarcophagus close to the mutilated statue of Anubis. On my return to Assiut, I had the mummy placed in my tent and thought no more of it till something woke me with a startling suddenness in the night. Then, obeying a peculiar impulse, I turned over on my side and looked in the direction of my treasure. The nights in the Sudan at this time of year are brilliant. One can even see to read. Every object in the desert is almost as clearly visible as by day. But I was quite startled by the whiteness of the glow which rested on the mummy, the face of which was immediately opposite mine. The remains, those of Met-Amkarema, lady of the college of the god Amun-Ra, were swathed in bandages, some of which had worn away in parts or become loose, and the figure, plainly discernible, was that of a shapely woman with elegant bust, well-formed limbs, rounded arms, and small hands. The thumbs were slender, and the fingers, each of which was separately bandaged, long and tapering. The neck was full, the cranium rather long, the nose aquiline, the chin firm. Imitation eyes, brows, and lips were painted on the wrappings, and the effect thus produced and in the phosphorescent glare of the moonbeams was very weird. I was quite alone in the tent, the only European who accompanied me to Assiut having stayed in the town by preference, and my servants being encamped at 100 or so yards from me on the ground. Sound travels far in the desert, but the silence now was absolute, and though I listened attentively, I could not detect the slightest noise. Man, beast, and insect were abnormally still. There was something in the air, too, which struck me as unusual. An odd, clammy coldness that reminded me at once of the catacombs in Paris. I had hardly, however, conceived the resemblance when a sob, low, gentle, but very distinct, sent a thrill of horror through me. It was ridiculous, absurd. It could not be, and I fought against the idea as to whence the sound had proceeded as something too utterly fantastic, too utterly impossible. I tried to occupy my mind with other thoughts, the frivolities of Cairo, the casinos of Nice, but all to no purpose. And soon, on my eager, throbbing ear, there again fell that sound, that low and gentle sob. My hair stood on end. This time there was no doubt, no possible manner of doubt. The mummy lived. I looked at it aghast. I strained my vision to detect any movement in its limbs, but none was perceptible. Yet the noise had come from it. It had breathed, and even as I hissed the words unconsciously through my clenched lips, the bosom of my mummy rose and fell. A frightful terror seized me. I tried to shriek to my servants. I could not ejaculate a syllable. I tried to close my eyelids, but they were held open as in a vice. Again there came a sob that was immediately succeeded by a sigh, and a tremor ran through the figure from head to foot. One of its hands then began to move. The fingers clutched the air convulsively, then grew rigid, then curled slowly into the palms, then suddenly straightened. The bandages concealing them from view then fell off, and to my agonized sight were disclosed objects that struck me as strangely familiar. There's something about fingers, a marked individuality I never forget. No two persons' hands are alike. And in these fingers, in their excessive whiteness, round knuckles, and blue veins, I read a likeness whose prototype, struggle how I would, I could not recall. Gradually the hand moved upwards, and reaching the throat, the fingers set to work at once to remove the wrappings. My terror was now sublime. I dare not imagine. I dare not for one instant think what I should see. And there was no getting away from it. I could not stir an inch, and the ghastly revelation would take place within a yard of my face. One by one, the bandages came off. A glimmer of skin, pale as marble. The beginning of the nose, the whole nose. The upper lip exquisitely, delicately cut. The teeth, white and even on the whole, but here and there a shining gold filling. The underlip, soft and gentle. A mouth I knew, but God, where? In my dreams, in the wild fantasies that had oft-times visited my pillow at night, in delirium, in reality, where, mon Dieu, where? The uncasing continued, the chin next, a chin that was purely feminine, purely classical. Then the upper part of the head, the hair long, black, luxuriant. The forehead, low and white. The brows, black, firmly penciled. And the last of all, the eyes. And as they met my frenzied gaze, smiled. Smiled right down in the depths of my living soul, I recognized them. They were the eyes of my mother who had died in my boyhood. Seized with a madness that knew no bounds, I sprang to my feet. The figure rose and confronted me. I flung open my arms to embrace her, the woman of all women in the world I loved best, the woman I had ever loved. Shrinking from my touch, she cowered against the side of the tent. I fell on my knees before her and kissed, what? Not the feet of my mother, but those of the long buried dead. Sick with repulsion and fear, I looked up, and there, bending over and peering into my eyes, was the face, the fleshless, moldering face of the foul and barely recognizable corpse. With a shriek of horror, I rolled backwards and, springing to my feet, prepared to fly. I glanced at the mummy. It was lying on the ground, stiff and still, every bandage in its place, while standing over it, a look of fiendish glee in its light, dog-like eyes was the figure of Anubis, lurid and menacing. The voices of my servants, assuring me they were coming, broke the silence, and in an instant, the apparition vanished. I'd had enough of the tent, however, at least for the night, and seeking refuge in the town, I whiled away the hours till morning with a fragrant cigar and a novel. Directly I had breakfasted, I took the mummy back to Thebes and left it there. No thank you, Mr. O'Donnell. I collect many kinds of curios, but no more mummies. Being first published in 1915 at a time when Egyptology was a big fad to the point where it was often called Egyptomania, it's not a surprise that Carrington would include a mummy story. Since he was trying to write a book like Phantasms of the Living, but in a more commercial manner, when he published True Ghost Stories, later to be called Phantasms of the Dead, this choice made sense. Is the mummy an apparition or an actual monster? Being that the image, surprisingly, was in the image of the percipient's mother, I tend to lean more on the apparition side of things because it would otherwise have to be a shape-shifting, mind-reading monster. When you get into the world of the paranormal, I suppose one cannot definitively dismiss anything, though. Having the mummy put in the tent where you sleep is asking for trouble. Still, even after the experience, he still took the mummy with him, but had the good sense to stay away from them thereafter. The next time you see a mummy in a museum, you might want to keep some distance. Just saying. If you want to hear more from Phantasms of the Dead, let me know. I would be happy to return to Mr. Carrington's work in future installments, but I think we'll go back to Phantasms of the Living next time, as we've barely scratched the surface of those two large volumes, and because that is the name of the podcast, after all. I'm Simon Thought, and I wrote and produced this, other than the parts read from Phantasms of the Dead, of course. Our theme song is called The Salad Bar, performed by my band, Simon Thought and the Uploads. Any comments from listeners about what you think these case studies mean would be appreciated. You can also tell me your story of phantasms you've experienced. I can be reached by email at simonthoughtandtheuploads@gmail.com. I will review and discuss further case studies in future episodes, and I hope you'll join me. Thank you for listening, and be vigilant. You never know when a phantasm will occur, so keep an eye out. Be well, and goodbye.